Welcome to the Oldie Podcast. This is from our literary lunch featuring guest speakers and kindly sponsored by Noble Caledonia, specialists in worldwide small ship cruising. Our lunches are held monthly. Details and how to book can be found in our magazine and on the website www.theoldie.co.uk.
Our last speaker, Nicholas Shakespeare, was named one of Grantham Magazine's 20 best of young British young novelists in that famous photograph. He wrote an acclaimed biography of the writer Bruce Chatwin, and he's now published a groundbreaking new biography, Ian Fleming, The Complete Man, by Nicholas Shakespeare. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks.
It gives me no small pleasure to be a guest here with you of the Oldie, which under the stewardship of James and Harry has become, for me, indisputably my favourite magazine. I'm a novelist before I'm a biographer, and I'm going to try and answer the question many of you may be asking yourselves: why is a fiction writer publishing a book on Ian Fleming? About 5 years ago, I'd begun a novel on a remote island as far away from England as I could get, and travel any further on your way home again. And I was facing the South Pole. I'd just begun writing, and a phone call goes from my agent in London saying, "We have a rather interesting proposition. The Fleming family would like to commission a new authorised biography of Ian Fleming. It'll be the first since 1966, when John Pearson wrote his marvellous book. Would you be interested?" And I confess that my first reaction after being flattered, I inhaled a bit of flattery, and my second reaction was hesitation, because I thought, do I really want to spend the next 3 or 4 years in the company of somebody I didn't have much knowledge of, but out of sideways glimpses, I conceived of him as a kind of Eldertonian, privileged bounder who had hit the road after whipping his wife and had gone off to the golf club and his boodles and come back late at night, fortified on scrambled eggs and martinis and cigarettes, and crawled up the narrow staircase to his monastic bedroom and fallen asleep with the blanket over his head, trying to block out the sniggers below of his wife's intellectual friends as they read aloud to great derision extracts from his latest Bond novel. One of the morals of the story I only realized when I finished the research is that don't run off with the wife of the owner of the Daily Mail if you wish to avoid forever after being rendered into tabloid fat, which it seems to me was the caricature I had imbibed and which seems to have taken root. So I asked the family, I said, "Look, this is very flattering, but could I do a couple of months of due diligence to see if I do want to spend time in this man's company?" And they said, "Okay." And three things happened in those 2 months. First of all, I discovered that he was much kinder than I'd hitherto anticipated. Again and again, the women he'd had affairs with, and as Rebecca West said, there were enough of them to fill the Albert Hall, poor dear, talked of his kindliness. I mean, Maud Russell, with whom he had an affair during the war, who bought him Goldeneye for £2,000 in 1946. 7 years after he dies, I found an unpublished diary extract in which she says, "I think of Ian and I think of his kindliness." This is not a characteristic that I associated with James Bond or the author of James Bond. And it's also applied to his male friends. They weren't as exciting as his female friends. There were many Eldertonian school friends who he played golf with and went to the club with and played bridge with. But they were very upright people. They were upstanding, like his grandfather, who'd founded Fleming's Bank. They were not people who had been taken in by a cad or a bounder. And they were very loyal, as he seems to have been to them. So for a biographer, that's quite a prize characteristic to try and retrieve. It wasn't in the Daily Mail caricature. The second thing that was surprising is that he was a lot more important than I'd realized. I mean, my old esteemed editor, Max Hastings, can't be shifted from his position that Fleming was basically, for 6 years in the war, in charge of in trays, out trays, and ashtrays. And this was also the image I had. He was a kind of rather, he loved his naval uniform, and he sat at his desk in room 39 and smoked lots of cigarettes. And really, while everybody else went out to the war and risked themselves, he was a desk-bound officer, a chocolate sailor. Well, this, I put some wire wool over this, and suddenly, although it's quite difficult to find because so many of the documents have been destroyed, bit by bit, a kind of papier-mâché model emerged of somebody who was absolutely in the inner sanctum of British intelligence, unlike two other writers who I knew, one of them quite well, John le Carré, Graham Greene, I knew less well. They had been on the peripheries of British intelligence. I mean, Greene was in Sierra Leone in a very minor function, and le Carré was in Hamburg. He didn't have a successful operation at all, I think. Fleming, by contrast, who wasn't able to curate his image as le Carré curated his, so that we think of Smiley, we think of le Carré before we think of George Smiley. With Fleming, we think of Bond before we think of Fleming. It's almost as if his creature has submerged him, and we forget Fleming. And one of the things I discovered is that to make Bond, he needed to have done all the things he did in his life to create Bond. But if he hadn't created Bond, we would still want to know about Fleming. He was a very important figure in British intelligence. He was, as I say, he was the inner sanctum. At the beginning of the war, he's given this amazing opportunity to have his fingers in all sorts of pies. For example, he kind of sets up a commando unit which goes and captures Enigma machines and code books and sends them back to Bletchley, which helped in many historians' estimation. That kind of work shortened the war by 18 months. He was also one of those responsible for creating the special relationship with America. In 1941, he goes to Washington, we're trying to get America into the war, and he helps to set up, based on naval intelligence, the Foreign Intelligence Organization of America. It's incredible to think America didn't have a Foreign Intelligence Organization in 1941. Fleming is one of two or three people in the room setting up the blueprint for what becomes the OSS, and then in 1947, the CIA. So he was quite important and quite nice. Now, that was interesting, but I'm still a bit inclined still to say no to this proposal. One or two other things emerged. Now, writers are quite superstitious as much as they're skeptical. Those are the two guiding stars of a writer. And we become quite spookily susceptible to little twinkles that suggest you're on the right path. And so I had a number of these twinkles. It turned out my father had shared a desk with John Pearson, the first biographer, in 1953 at the Times Education Supplement. And 66 years later, I brought them back together. And John Pearson gave me his Fleming file, which is an incredible piece of material. And he gave me his benediction to continue in his footsteps. He had, after he left my father at the desk in the Times Education Supplement, he'd become Fleming's assistant at the Sunday Times on Atticus. My father had become the assistant to Frank Giles in Paris. It was Frank Giles who then became and took over from Fleming as foreign manager of the Sunday Times. There were other Shakespeare connections. My grandfather had served in the First World War at Ypres, and there was one day when Val Fleming, Fleming's father, comes to help him take 359 stretchers from the hospital at Ypres, and they both inhale the same cloud of chlorine gas. And I have both of their accounts in a diary. These are tiny little things, but they suggested I was possibly the right person to be thinking of doing this. My great uncle Geoffrey, who was a member of this club, he was a cabinet minister, liberal cabinet minister, and he was Churchill's private secretary, financial secretary at the Admiralty during those early months of the Second World War, when he greets Churchill, and Churchill gives Geoffrey his first order, which is get me a bottle of whiskey. And he is directly above Fleming for 9 months at room 39, pacing the floor with Churchill above. So Geoffrey would have met Fleming every day during those corridors. My son, at the time I was asked to do this, happened to be in the same house at Eton as Fleming, and like him had won the Victor Ludorum, which Fleming always thought was his greatest achievement at Eton. I had a strange connection with my mother's side. My grandfather had taught Alec Waugh at Sherborne and published his scandalous novel, The Loom of Youth. And This had caused a great ruction about homosexuality at British public schools in 1917. And my grandfather had totally said to Alec Waugh, if you want to write, you have to do 2,000 words every morning without fail, allow nothing to interrupt this. Alec Waugh, who'd gone to Jamaica in the 1920s, meets Fleming and tells him of this rule to be a writer, you have to do these 2,000 words every day, which was my grandfather's rules. My grandfather had encouraged Alec Waugh with stories in Jamaica of our ancestors of ours who'd gone out to have a sugar plantation. And we'd had a family of some of our workers there. My grandfather always wanted to go out to Jamaica and see his black relations. And Alec Waugh, after the war, 1953, can't get published anymore. It's Evelyn Waugh who is the great writer. Alec Waugh's thinking of committing suicide. His son told me he lines up the barbiturates. And then he bumps into my grandfather, who has full of a story. He's just met his cousin, Roger Mace, a black poet, and it's amazing how they got on together. Alec Waugh goes off and writes a novel for which he's given the biggest advance in Hollywood history. It's called Island in the Sun, partly inspired by my grandfather's story. In Jamaica, a young man called Chris Blackwell, who is the son of Ian Fleming's last mistress, decides to create a record company called Island Records based on this. Chris Blackwell is now the owner of Goldeneye, where Fleming wrote all his 14 Bond books. These are tiny, unimportant strands, but they were quite exciting to me. The final strand, before Harry beats the gong, my Icelandic-Canadian wife said, oh yes, I think we've got links with Fleming through William Stevenson. William Stevenson was thought by Fleming to be one of the great spy chiefs of the Second World War, and Fleming said if there was a model for Bond, it was Stevenson. You'll probably know him as the man called Intrepid, the quiet Canadian. He was sent out by Churchill in 1940 to run British intelligence in New York and Washington, and it's with him and William Donovan that Fleming sets up what becomes the OSS. Now, everyone, I said, well, to my wife, well, why is he linked to your family? He said, well, he's not a quiet Canadian at all. My father-in-law, revealed to the world that William Stevenson was in fact a man called William Stanger, who'd been left in Winnipeg, aged 4, by his Icelandic mother, and been adopted by my wife's family, the Stefansons, whose anglicized name he took, so he became William Stevenson. And in 1922, he leaves Winnipeg in disgrace, having bankrupted most of my father-in-law's patients, who he tried to get invest in a company fabricating can openers. Anyway, on the ship from Winnipeg to England, he meets a Tennessee tobacco heiress who then funds his next ventures, which is to persuade Max Beaverbrook, a fellow Canadian, to invest in some of his inventions. He becomes a very important industrialist. He meets Churchill. Churchill, in 1940, sends him to America to help set up our intelligence network. So I thought, well, all these things combine together to make me think I should do this book. And so I agreed to write the biography of Ian Fleming.
Thank you so much, Nick. And just to prove that the oldie is at the cockpit of world events, I think room 39 is just across the road in Whitehall, isn't it? Nick, it all happened near here. Thank you all so much for coming. I have one last duty, which is to announce the winner of the oldie raffle. Forgive me if I'm pronouncing your surname wrongly. It's Melissa McCaddle from Studham.
She left.
She's already gone to get her prize. But thank you all so much for coming. All three speakers will be just outside the door, not where they were before lunch, literally outside this door to sign your copies. But thank you all so much for coming to the Aldi lunch today. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Aldi podcast. Please share this episode. Look out for the Oldie magazine subscription offer on our website www.theoldie.co.uk. Thank you and good luck.